Welcome to the New Zealand Motoring Podcast, brought to you by podcasts.co.nz.
Hello and welcome to the second New Zealand Motoring Podcast. A big thank you to everyone who actually listened to the last one and gave us all this wonderful positive feedback that we've had. I'm Damien O'Carroll.
And I'm David Linklater.
And with us today we have a special guest, Cameron Officer.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me along.
Oh, it's all right. Thank you for coming.
First guest, how exciting.
Indeed, yes. Now, Cameron, we all, David and I both know you from the Top Gear New Zealand magazine involvement, which you used to be editor of.
Good times, indeed.
Pre-GFC, great times.
Yeah, you used to pay us money. We used to like cars.
Champagne and big envelopes full of money.
That's every time you got a test car. Yep. Top Gear jet, corporate jet, you know, that sort of stuff.
No, what are you up to these days, Cameron?
Well, I went freelance a few years back, and strangely enough, I'm still writing about cars, otherwise I guess you wouldn't have bothered inviting me along at all, but I'm actually spending a fair bit of my time writing about construction machinery, of all things. So the very specific purpose for these machines, a lot of horsepower, writing about things going on in Christchurch and Wellington, all involving big yellow and orange machines.
Awesome.
With flashing lights.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Fantastic. Why don't we just kick off with some news, eh?
Indeed.
As previewed last podcast, actually, New Zealand Car of the Year was announced on December the 4th, and as predicted by the New Zealand Motoring Podcast, it was the Mazda 3. I don't know whether we can pat ourselves on the back too much there, because it was a fairly clear winner, I think.
It was pretty comprehensive.
We were both in agreement, I think, that it was almost a dead cert, and we didn't get proved wrong, luckily. So that's sort of the third Sky Active technology Mazda that's come along, and probably the best, actually, the other two being the Mazda 6 and Mazda CX-5. And there's actually three more of those Skyactiv Mazdas to come. They've just launched the Mazda 2, and there is the new MX-5 to come, and also a little thing called the CX-3, which I saw at the Los Angeles Motor Show earlier this year. And that's quite a neat little thing. It's a little crossover based on the Mazda 2. So it may well be that Mazda's in with another chance next year for Car of the Year, because they're all quite interesting cars.
Indeed, and certainly good for some sales with the CX-3, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's a burgeoning market segment, sort of small crossover, so that's going to be a really important one, I think.
Very much so. On a completely different note, I came across the other day on the interweb a fantastic series of art prints from a very talented artist called Darren Rawlings. He's from Toronto, Canada. He's on DeviantArt and Tumblr. And they're basically a series of prints of famous movie and television cars that he's imagined what they would be like if they were Transformers. And it's very, very new.
Who hasn't done that?
Well, he's put it on paper, or whatever the digital equivalent of paper is these days. We'll have the pictures up on our Facebook page, which, as you will have guessed by now, this is just a blatant plug to get you to go to our Facebook page, as well as a few links to Darren's various websites that are worth checking out. He is very, very talented, and the Transformers are just cool.
What's the best one?
The best one, my pick would be the Back to the Future DeLorean that transforms into a robot that holds a hoverboard, which is the way to go.
It's fantastic the way people think of different things to do with DeLoreans, because they weren't much good as cars. From Transformers onto Utes, sales figures for the year are not quite out. We're up to the end of November in terms of official figures, but an interesting thing about the sales figures at the moment is that the Toyota Hilux has sort of fallen from its top spot as the country's most popular Ute.
After how 32 years, is it?
32 years. So that's going to be a bit sad for Toyota, I think, because it was such a big part of the brand to be the country's number one. I mean, people have great feelings about the Hilux, but in reality it is the oldest and probably least impressive utility on the market, isn't it?
I think the fact that it is actually still fighting with the Ranger for the number one spot, and given the fact that it is nearly a 10-year-old ute, is impressive.
It says a fair bit about its original DNA as a ute, doesn't it?
The Toyota name. But
So the gap is not huge, actually. It's 300 units. So Hilux, the Ranger has sold about 5,600 Hilux Hilux is around 5,300, so it's only 300 cars, but there's no way Toyota's going to catch up, and they've already admitted they're not going to catch up. So, yeah, the war is over for this year with Utes. They'll be, I guess, looking forward to next year when they have something newer and bigger and shinier to offer us. They're not exactly going to be crying. They're still by far the leaders in the commercial segment. I think they've sold something like 14,000 vehicles in the commercial segment, so that includes Hilux but also Hiaces and other things, and Holden is in number two there, and they're well behind with about 9,400, so Toyota will still be happy.
Oh, sure they will be, and probably a good time for the buyers too, if you want to pop in before the end of the year, buy a Hilux, buy it one is, get 300 free. I don't they is, might right.
Well, they're doing some mighty special editions, aren't they?
They are.
Sportivos and Edges and things, and so
this,
yeah,
this new Hiace coming out, sorry, a facelifted Hiace coming next year too, so there might be some deals on Hiace.
They will.
moving on from commercial vehicles to something a bit more sexy. Ferrari have just delivered the first of the Ferrari Sergios that they decided that they would build.
What is this you speak of?
What is this, Sergio? Well,
Who's Sergio?
It was a design that Pininfarina showed at the Geneva Motor Show in 2013 as a tribute to their recently deceased chairman, Sergio Pininfarina. Basically, it's a 458 Spider with a different body on it. So it's not exactly a massive engineering challenge for Ferrari, but it was a good example to sell six 458s at vastly inflated prices.
Has it got one of those RIP Sergio stickers in the back window?
And a Gothic font. I've had a quick look at it, and I think it looks kind of cool. It almost looks like a Ferrari crossed with a Lancia Stratos.
Yes. It's a very sort of 70s retro design. The original concept actually didn't have a windscreen, so they had to change that for the production version.
Who needs windscreens?
They're overrated. Well, the first one's been delivered, rather unsurprisingly, to the Middle East.
Right. And how many were they going to build?
Six.
Six.
So they'll all go to Ferrari owners, I would imagine.
I would imagine so. They tend to do that. Do you own a dozen Ferraris? Well, here's another one you can buy for a vastly overrated price.
Is your FXX too common?
Yeah, well, I mean,
something new.
We'll put up pictures of the concept and the production car on the Facebook page, which I forgot to mention before is facebook.com/NZ Motoring Podcast, which would help if you're looking for that. So check those out and don't forget to like us, because we're desperate for validation.
I'm going to steer you away from Ferrari.
You do that.
Because that's my thing. I read yesterday, there's a report on Reuters that Mahindra, which of course is the Indian maker of 4x4s and Utes, I think India's biggest maker of 4x4 and Utes actually, and you can buy Mahindras here as well, they are going to buy National Electric Vehicle Sweden. What is that, you ask? That's the company that bought Saab back in 2012, I think. Now, calling themselves National Electric Vehicle Sweden is just a clever way of disguising that it's actually a Chinese conglomerate. And their plan was to take over the Saab factory, start making a range of all-electric cars out of the old 9-3, and they had big plans to sell these in China. They didn't really get started, to be honest. They made a few 9-3s, not electric ones, just 9-3s.
Just 9-3s.
Because heaven knows,
somewhere in the world,
they probably just found a few lying around out the back of the factory somewhere. That someone
heaven
forgotten.
Knows that we don't have enough 9-3s. So that project has fallen over. It looks like Mahindra stepped in to buy it. And so one or two things could happen. They're either planning to make a range of Utes out of the Saab 9-3, or they're planning to use some of that Saab expertise to make a range of luxury cars. Your guess is as good as mine.
That the keys will be in the middle of the console regardless.
They will. I mean, the odd thing is the 9-3, of course, is quite an old car, and the deal wouldn't include, you know, the most modern Saab, which was the new 9-5, which was sort of launched just before the company went under, sort of back in 2011. I mean, that was a great car, but GM sort of put the kibosh on any of that technology going elsewhere, because they had quite a bit invested in the platform. So yeah, the deal is just for the old 9-3 and the factory in Sweden.
So
although we might just see Mahindra badged sedans. And
could well. Wagons. That'd be great, wouldn't it? I'd actually drive one of those.
A Mahindra, yeah.
Mahindra Badge 93.
Mahindra 93, yeah.
I think the great thing about it is, all joking aside, that it just shows that you can't kill Saab. I love
God,
Saab.
God knows General Motors tried.
They did. They've tried for decades. But it just won't go away. People love the brand, and I love the brand, and you know, I think it'd be great if it got a second or third or fourth or fifth lease of life, whichever one it's on now. But good on them.
At least they give it either go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, well, let's move on from the news. It's enough of that. Enough news. We'll go into what we have been driving recently.
Well, a fantastic question. What have you been driving?
What have I been driving? I've been driving a very interesting car, the Lexus NX300H. Now, this is a 2.5-litre hybrid with... based on the RAV4 platform and running the hybrid drivetrain out of the Lexus.
Say that.
Lexus, I know Toyota / Lexus don't like you pointing out those facts, but anyway, that's what it is. It's about RAV4 size, surprisingly enough. It's an SUV hybrid, very pleasant car, retails for $95,900 for the four-wheel drive.
Now, unlike your guffawing, in fairness, that's the most expensive variant, isn't it?
They start at around 80. That's the four-wheel drive limited. They start, the two-wheel drive non-limited ordinary one starts at $81,900.
Still quite a lot of money.
still rather expensive, yeah. RAV4.
So it's about 20, it's probably what, $15,000 more than the top RAV4?
Yes, that'd be right, because the RAV4 actually tops out at quite a large amount of
it
money.
It does, yeah, it's in the 60s.
They're guaranteed to catch more eyes than the top RAV4.
Oh, absolutely. It's a fantastic looking car. Yeah. It's very packed angular. Full of all sorts of very, very angular.
Japanese.
Yes, yeah. Very Japanese.
Well, it's kind of bold for Lexus, because Lexus traditionally, they've gone off that American market. Yeah. Well, that's what they're basically created to do. So to have something so Japanese, that spindle grille they have at the front, that's very, very...
very, very brave. Yeah. And it is something that they decided to do a while back, is... go back to being very Japanese, with very Japanese styling. It did.
Now, I've had a little bit of experience with that car, not as much as you, but I do have a two-part question for you, because I suspect that under there's actually quite a sporty car, A, because the RAV4 is actually quite good to drive, and B, because there is a 2-litre petrol turbo version of this NX coming, which sounds quite good. I haven't driven it, but my question to you is, does a hybrid powertrain suck the soul out of a car?
I would tend to say yes, possibly there, because it does take a lot of the traditional, what we would call fun, out of driving your car.
Yeah.
You've got to drive it in a very different fashion, and for that end, the 300H is a very relaxed, comfortable, luxury car. If there is a sporty car hidden under there somewhere, it is quite well hidden at this stage, although the 2-litre turbo engine may be enough to pull out a bit more excitement in it.
To be honest, I can't see how can't be good to drive the 2-litre turbo one, because the RAV4 is good. A RAV4 with a hot engine in it would be a great little SUV, I think, and I think this NX will be.
I would suspect so, but as it stands now, the hybrid is definitely a luxury cruiser.
And it is very economical, isn't
it? It's very economical, it's very comfortable, it's extremely quiet.
It does about 5.5 litres per 100 km, I think.
5.7.
5.7, there you go. So that's pretty good for a petrol-powered, you know, four-wheel drive. And it's quite a big car, isn't it?
It is, it's a large car. Admittedly, it's four-wheel drive, but it's not going off the road anywhere soon.
No, but I mean, it's nudging up towards the size of the RX, which is Lexus's larger SUV.
In fact, it almost dwarfs the RX in some aspects. I don't know if it actually does physically, but it certainly looks like it does.
Yeah.
Which leads me to suspect that the next RX will in fact move up a size to...
I think you can count on that.
Based on that prediction, the LX will be simply enormous by the time that...
Well, the big question is what they do with the LX, because it is quite an old school vehicle.
Mind you, the Land Cruiser is on the Toyota side of the coin too, and they'll never let that one go.
And there's a big market in the Middle East and the States still for that big LX.
So the LX will survive until all the oil runs out.
And just when you think Lexus are only concerned with saving fuel, they release something like the RC.
Ah, yes. I've been driving the RC. So the RC is Lexus's new coupe. So it's sort of a bid to make the brand a little bit more sexy, I suppose. I mean, they're always talking about making the brand more sexy, but this is as good a attempt as any. So it's a coupe. It's not cheap. Starts at about $120,000 for an entry-level model, goes right up to $174,000 for the RCF Carbon, which is the V8 one that's laden with carbon fibre body parts. It's got carbon fibre bonnet and all sorts, so that's like your need for speed version. The six-cylinder ones have got a 3.5 V6 engine, about 230 kilowatts, and the big V8 is essentially the replacement for the ISF sedan, I suppose. That was kind of their Hero F model, and so this RCF replaces that. I've actually had quite a good time in these vehicles over the past year, I must say. I went to New York and drove it at Monticello Racing Circuit, which is a private motor racing club where Jerry Seinfeld is a member.
Ooh.
Didn't seem to be there that day.
Not it being a Porsche.
Yes. So that was a great experience. And then we sort of repeated that for the New Zealand launch by going to Highlands Park in Cromwell, the absolutely fantastic. Again,
where Jerry Seinfeld isn't actually a member.
No, he's not. But there are plenty of Porsches there. So, yeah, interesting car. It's not actually directly based on anything else in the lineup. There's bits of GS in there. There's bits of IS in there. There's actually the bit in the middle is the old shape IS convertible,
right,
just because that's got a bit more torsional rigidity. Make it, you know, a bit stiffer to make the coupe a better drive.
One assumes for that the F version, they must have benchmarked M cars and AMG cars.
Very much got their sights set on the M car, yeah.
The interesting thing about the pricing there is previously the ISF was always priced considerably under the C63, yep, and the M3 and the like.
What was that, about 140 mark?
It was around there, because the, yeah, M3 was about 150. Now the M3 tops out at about 165, is it, for the...
I think it might be around there for the M4, and the M3, yeah, 4-door's a bit cheaper.
So that means that the RCF is, well, the carbon edition certainly
that's the
is
carbon edition. That's a very niche car. The V8 one is a little bit, the standard V8 one is a little bit cheaper, but they are full of confidence for two reasons. Number one, they're not planning to sell a whole bunch of them. They're not going for sort of M car volume.
No.
Number two is they're very, very proud of that they're still a V8 brand.
Yep.
It's basically a new V8 engine. It runs in the Atkinson cycle at low speed, like a Prius, to save fuel, and then it
just like a Prius,
and then flips into the conventional Otto cycle when you're going a bit faster. So it's a really clever engine. And yeah, they've absolutely committed to V8s. They say they've got no plans to do anything different with their flagship F models. They're always going to be V8s.
That's still a Yamaha developed V8, isn't it?
It is. Fantastic engine. Yeah. It's a big, heavy car. I mean, it's a fantastic track car, that RCF. It really is. But you've got to drive it smoothly. It's heavy. It's not something you would throw around. So in that respect, it's a bit different in character, I suppose, to an BMW M car. Probably more along the lines of your AMG vehicle, really. Certainly is loud.
Yeah.
Makes a fantastic noise.
That's all it matters.
Yeah.
Lots of angry angles and
sold. You'll have loud
noise. Yes.
Yeah.
It is a dramatic looking thing. It's pretty.
You probably get 300 Hiluxes free if you bought one. Anyway. Moving on to a more off-roady bent, I recently went to the launch of the Subaru Outback, all new one, which apparently now is an SUV.
Yeah, you need to explain that.
As opposed to
a wagon, yeah, that's slightly raised up. It now comes in a much wider range of models. It's got a 2.5-litre petrol four-cylinder boxer engine. It's got a 2-litre diesel. It's got the 3.6-litre six-cylinder engine. It comes across several different models. No prices yet.
Why not?
Well, they're still negotiating with Japan. But the thing is, they have to get this one priced right.
Yeah.
Because the last Outback was a reasonably expensive car for what it was. And this time round, they've actually got no legacy wagon. So the lower model in the Outback range kind of got to fill up that...
No legacy wagon. Why not?
However, the Levorg will be coming very shortly, which is basically a legacy sport wagon.
Do you know what Levorg stands for? I read this the other day.
I grovel backwards. I don't know.
It's a contraction of, are you ready? Legacy Revolution Touring. Or as one of our colleagues pointed out the other day, it's actually grovel backwards.
Yeah. But anyway.
So but that's coming a bit later.
That is coming later in the year next year. The Outback will be out in February.
Subaru have always pitched themselves at the sort of premium, not always, but recently, last few iterations of the Legacy and Outback have been pitched
absolutely
at that kind of premium end. So what's your gut saying? It's still going to be a $60,000 car?
I would imagine the top...
They're probably hoping for that.
Well, I mean, the top of the range, 3.6, is a very, very luxurious car. I mean, it'll be up there.
I thought the interesting thing about that 3.6 one was that it's gone to a... I want to say continuously variable, but I'm not allowed to because Subaru will call up and yell at me. The Subaru Linear-Tronic transmission, which is sort of their gearless transmission that's in all of their vehicles now, including the WRX.
Yeah, it's
quite, but it's moved
like
from
it.
A...
I quite like it in the WRX, though.
It actually works quite well in the...
Speaking as someone who hates CVTs, which is just as well because this clearly isn't a CVT.
No.
I actually like the transmission across all the cars now.
Yeah.
Particularly the diesel and the larger, more powerful...
Works really well with the diesel.
Works brilliantly with the diesel. The diesel is surprisingly good off-road.
Yeah.
It's got the torque just where you need it.
That's because it's an SUV.
It's because it is an SUV. Well, it does have 221 millimetres of ground clearance, which is actually getting into the fairly useful territory for going off-road.
They're Subaru very proud of the fact they're 100% four-wheel drive, aren't they?
Absolutely.
But that's also the difficulty with the pricing, because there's so many cars out there that are crossover / SUV and two-wheel drives.
They did go out of their way to make the point that it needs to be remembered when buyers are looking at those cars.
Yes.
Because you can get a Captiva or a similar SUV-style vehicle in two-wheel drive that's considerably cheaper.
Indeed you can.
But, yeah.
And I think the other point they make, which is probably a valid one, is that four-wheel drive is actually useful on-road as well for extra traction and wet conditions and, you know, just better handling balance and all that sort of stuff. But, yeah, they're, on one hand, forcefully hammering home the point that four-wheel drive is the way to go, and on the other hand, nervous about the fact that their cars are more expensive than the others.
Yeah. That said, though, I mean, there's a lot of diehard Subaru fans out there who will just buy one regardless.
Yeah,
as they pointed out in their new advertising campaign, what was it, the highest number of Subarus per capita in New Zealand.
But they're counting used imports.
So they haven't sold all those.
In their defence, Subaru have always been very good at supporting used imports.
They have, yes. Yep.
Most brands will pretend that they don't exist.
Yep.
Subaru have had that Sublabs, I think it's called, where they've actually tried to get those owners. I guess the idea is, sure, they bought an ex-Singapore Legacy this time, but they might buy a New Zealand.
They might buy a new one next time, so bring them into the fold.
I appreciate that.
Makes sense.
Yep.
And it certainly is a nice car, and it certainly does deserve to do well, but it will come down to the pricing, so that will be interesting to see.
You know how I steered you away from Ferraris and onto Utes before?
Yes.
I'm going to steer you away from off-roading and onto racetracks now.
Well, here we go.
I've just been to Queensland to do two things at the same time. One is to drive the latest Porsche 911 GT3, and the other is to participate in the Porsche Sport Driving School.
Level
four.
I believe there was a third thing, and that was to talk about it incessantly until everyone's sick of it.
You've both known me for a long time, and you've heard me drone on about Porsche 911s for long periods of time, and I'm just here to tell you that I'm going to do it again now. So the Porsche 911 GT3 is kind of the track day car of the range, really special car, $275,000, so it should be pretty special. But it's got a naturally aspirated six-cylinder engine, so none of this turbo nonsense. It's 350 kilowatts. It revs to 9,000 RPM. It gets to 100 k's an hour in 3.5 seconds, and you can hammer it all around the track as hard as you like all day and park it up and do it all again tomorrow.
Drive home in between times.
Well, you honestly can, and it's the sole car that they use for level four of this course. Because it's so good, you know, they claim that they can, you know, do track days with this thing, stick it in the garage overnight, wheel it out again the next morning, you know, and they get quite a long time out of the tyres as well. It's got Michelin Sport Cup tyres, which are specifically designed for this car. So it's a great car, obviously, just phenomenal car, and a great course as well. You get to sit alongside proper drivers like Craig Beard and Thomas Mazera, both of whom were there on the day that I did the course.
Yelling at me.
So you get
to see great Porsche drivers with looks of massive despair on their faces.
No, they said they were intrigued that I'd found some new ways around some of the corners. So I think I did quite well. So, yeah, you get about 30 laps. Now, it costs about Australian $3,500 to do the course. You don't have to own a Porsche. Anybody can do it. And they're really busy. They do, you know, several courses a week, some weeks. So it's all on. And you get a few sort of instructional laps with the driver beside you, and then it's, you're all by yourself, and they basically observe from the track, and they're in radio contact, and they talk you around. And the idea, is to have fun, obviously, because you're paying a lot of money, and, you know, if you're not having fun after spending $3,500 for a track day, then there's something wrong, but also to learn a little bit and improve your lap times. And, you know, if you come away from a course like that after, you know, talking to somebody like Craig Baird, and you're not a little bit better than when you went in, then there's something desperately wrong. But it's a great day. Thoroughly recommend it. The only downside possibly is that I've never done levels 1, 2, and 3, so maybe that's why I was all over the track. But it's a fantastic day, and I got a certificate.
Hey,
yeah, hey. Says I participated.
And a model?
Oh, I got a model. I'm fondling the model as we speak. It's even got the Porsche Sport Driving School logo on it, and it's white, just like the one I drove.
Has it got your name on the window?
I wish.
No. That would be too much detail.
Would be too much.
Mini champs couldn't do that fast.
That's a bit of a, at least you gave it a go prize, isn't it?
So it is an awesome car. It's the GT3's had a few problems earlier in the year. It was Porsche grounded every single car globally earlier this year, I think around February, because engines started catching fire. So they've come up with a fix for that. They basically redeveloped the entire engine. It was all down to a screw on one of the pistons, I think, which was malfunctioning and causing fires. So every single car on the ground, and I think there were two in owner's hands in New Zealand and another 5 or 6 sort of in stock, they have all had the engines replaced. So the engines have come out, been sent back to the factory and been destroyed or whatever. They've assured that none of those engines... Just to anticipate your question, they've ensured that none of those engines will ever be fitted to a car. Some of them are being used for training and obviously...
Thought there might be a cheaper sort of...
No.
Performance edition Volkswagen or something come out with the
PTG. Yeah, it comes with a fire extinguisher.
Fire extinguisher, yes.
Yeah. So all those cars are back on the road now and actually, obviously
just,
in fine form.
Just interjecting there, I would personally, if I was the owner of one of those cars and they replaced my engine, I would demand the old engine back.
As a coffee table?
Exactly, to make the most awesome coffee table on the planet.
That's a good...
That's an idea. I don't think that was an offer that was made...
I doubt it.
Do you want to decorate your home with a spare engine unit?
Because there would be a lot of suspiciously grunting sound and combis running around.
That's right.
Should we move on to talk about today's feature?
I think we should. We're all itching to because we're just big nerds.
What is it? Excited.
It's James Bond.
Dun, 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 dun.
Recently, they announced the new Bond movie will be called Spectre. Ooh, harking back to the old days now that they've won their lawsuit and can use that name again.
Now, can I just say that if you don't know about the lawsuit and you don't know what Spectre stands for, you should switch off now.
Yes.
Yeah. Sorry to have dragged
it. It's going to get deeply nerdy now. Or you could just fire up the computer and open up Google and start getting lost in the world of nerdiness that we find ourselves in all the time. They announced that the new movie and some of the cast and, more importantly, the new car.
Which they actually announced before
they
the
did.
Movie. They actually announced this was going to be part of the movie before the movie.
Sam Mendes unveiled the car before he announced any of the cast. Oh, so that's,
that just gives you an indication of the product placement.
Yeah,
indeed.
Some big, big dollars.
And as a result, the world's most conspicuous spy becomes even more obvious by driving a car that has been designed specifically for this movie.
But everyone's very excited about it, aren't they? And they're saying, you know, it's a brand new Aston Martin for this movie. It's actually not. It's a V8 Vantage that's been rebodied.
Which, let's face it, Aston have been doing that for quite a number of years now, so there's nothing new about that.
One
assumes they'll spin some sort of production variant.
Well, they are going to build 10 of them, and apparently the styling of the DB10 does mirror future Aston Martins.
Right. Oh, they always say that.
They always say that, but it does look fairly similar to existing Aston Martins, just on a slightly different shaped body.
Maybe a sharper nose.
Yeah, it's a bit sort of, it's got creases and it's...
Yeah.
sort of
grill off a Ford Fiesta. Yeah,
grill off a Ford Fiesta. So yeah. But
The other product placement fact, which has come out since that press conference, is that the villain in the movie is going to be driving the Jaguar CX-75. Did you know this?
Oh, I didn't know that.
So the CX-75 is a prototype vehicle which Jaguar were going to build as a production car. It's like a hybrid supercar. Mm. But they canned the project, but obviously there are still some cars floating around. So they're going to modify that for filming. So the villain of the piece is going to be driving a Jaguar. And that is yet more product placement because, of course, it fits with the advertising campaign that Jaguar is doing in the UK at the moment, which is It's Good to Be Bad.
Oh,
and they have a whole range of British actors who are famous for playing bad guys, including Ben Kingsley and all sorts of people featured in this advertisement driving Jaguars. So, yeah, it's more product placement dollars.
And so now the leader of a terrorist organisation is going to drive a highly, highly obvious one-off vehicle, thereby making...
Well, I think it's one thing you learn from Bond movies is that you never hide. The spies never hide, the villains never hide. It's all very open.
No. It's all very open.
It's a different world.
But we sort of got talking about this topic, and we realised that, you know, the Aston Martins and the Lotuses and things are the cars that everyone's excited about. They always want to talk about. So we thought we'd talk about something else, which is the car, not so famous cars that have been in Bond movies, the best worst Bond cars, in other words. Cars. Yeah.
The anti-hero cars.
Because it's all I almost get more of a kick out of looking back at those old movies and looking at some of the peripheral cars, some of the oddities that he drives and is passengered in. And so I was looking back at Die Another Day, actually, which incidentally is arguably the worst Bond film ever made.
On so many levels.
Yeah.
And it was the 20th.
Which,
so much promise.
Yeah,
so.
Which is apt because it was the 20th, they sort of peppered through all these references to the old movies, including props and things, which could have been a nice idea, but it was just way overdone. But in one scene in it, the Pierce Brosnan James Bond character drives a 1957 Ford Skyliner, which is a lovely old car. It was intended as an homage to the very first car that a James Bond movie character was ever pictured in, which was a 1957 Chevrolet Bel Air, which was Sean Connery in Dr. No. Now, the reason why Pierce Brosnan wasn't driving a Chevrolet Bel Air is because that movie had Ford product placement, and it had to be a Ford, which just is ridiculous.
It has to raise the pettiest clause in a product placement contract on the face of the
planet. Absolutely.
It's just terrible. Ford really owned the Bond cars through
that period.
Well, they did, because they had the Premier Automotive Group, which included at that time Volvo, Jaguar, other cars. So yeah, they basically had it covered.
They spent quite a lot of money to dislodge Bond from BMWs, what he was in.
Which, let's face it, was a bit of a cul-de-sac as far as Bond folklore goes. For you know, as far as what we hear, we had the Z3,
which was awful,
which was just terrible.
Can I say? I must say, the Z3 from GoldenEye, wasn't it?
Yeah,
which on screen for about 3 minutes.
No gadgets.
At the time, the world's biggest in terms of money product placement movie deal ever. Yes, it was just massive. Right. All that for such a small amount of screen time. Mm. I have seen that car. It's in the BMW Museum in Munich. And I went there, and it was in the middle of the room, actually. They're proud of it.
Oh, really?
Are they?
And a Z3 is not a great car anyway, but you know, a Z3 Bond just makes you feel sad. And I went and stood next to it, and I just sort of went... and moved on. I don't know that the Z8 was much better either.
No, at least that was kind of a bit more cultish, I suppose.
Well, at least it got chopped up by a helicopter with big saws under it, so that was kind of cool.
That was a good scene.
You know, supervillains for years have tried to kill or humiliate James Bond, and BMW did it in one foul swoop by putting him in a Z3, so you could argue that's a triumph.
But you're right about Ford, because am I right in thinking the first time we ever see Daniel Craig drive a vehicle, it's a Mondeo hire car?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, how low-key an entry to the world of Bond cars is that?
Well, it wasn't low-key at all, was it? Because the lingering camera shots over the car
it was like a car ad in the middle of a Bond movie.
Yeah.
So excited to hire a car as this.
The only thing to distract you was the fact that he was looking up the sat-nav on his Sony Ericsson phone. Texting and driving, don't do it.
No,
people.
Don't do it.
And
no.
I think looking back at it, back in these days, it just goes to show you how long ago that movie actually
2006.
Was 2006. Yeah, because the Mondeo is a very old car now,
and it was not even out at that time. In fact, the car that's in the movie is not a real car. It's a prototype, oh, and wow. I think a lot of it might even be clay.
You still smell the wood glue.
You can. That's why he was looking a bit dazed when he was driving it. He was overcome by the smell of glue,
tin foil.
But that was obviously a really big deal. It was basically the global launch for the car, and they're obviously very excited about having James Bond drive it. Those of us who love James Bond movies are probably not quite so excited about seeing a brand new James Bond being introduced in a Ford Mondeo, but no. There you go.
Then they shoehorned the new Ford car into the next movie, didn't they?
They did. They
quite
did.
An obvious way to, but it was, at least Bond didn't have to drive
it. He didn't drive it, no.
No.
No, that's right. And then, of course, so am I right in thinking that Lotus was also pure product placement before my adolescent mind could catch up with such a concept? Or
I don't know whether it was
Roger Moore.
It was paid for, or I think there was a bit of mutual admiration, I think. Because Lotus at the time was sort of struggling to find an audience for the Esprit, as it was back then in the mid-70s, and one of the Lotus PR people parked the car out in front of the studio, didn't they? To catch the attention of the producers, because they knew that a new Bond film was in the works.
They had several goes at it. They several days. Yeah, waving, tooting. They did it at lunchtime, I believe.
Yes.
So when the executives came out, see this car parked out the front, and then one day the driver would sort of just be hanging around it looking innocent, and one of them came up and talked to him. And
you wonder whether that's one of those urban myths.
You do have to wonder that.
I've heard that story so many times.
A good story, though.
I do have a Bond fact, though, around that car, and that is when they did the big car chase in The Spy Who Loved Me, which involved a helicopter and motorbikes and all sorts of things. The stunt driver that they had employed to drive the car was having a lot of trouble getting it to slide around, because being a very, very low and light car, mid-engined, very hard to get it to sort of move around unless you were really familiar with its handling characteristics. And so the Lotus employee, who was a test driver, who was charged with actually delivering the car to Sardinia, ended up driving the car in those scenes, and he was obviously knew the car very well and was able to make it slide around and do everything they wanted. So yeah, that was his 15 minutes of fame, I guess.
He probably had a chicken flag cravat as well, I mean.
Oh, he would have. Yes. I say.
Plus, I think his big advantage probably was that he was well used to the smell of plastics and glue that would have permeated the cabin, so he didn't feel woozy either while he was driving it.
Another Bond fact is that Elon Musk of Tesla fame actually owns the Esprit submarine he's determined to make it a proper submarine.
Oh, which just builds to my theory that Elon Musk is in fact a Bond villain.
Absolutely.
And he will attempt to take over the world.
Why else would he want a subterranean monorail?
Exactly.
Cities in West Coast. I mean, it's just absolutely out of a Bond film, isn't it?
He's also the first man to wear a sports coat with jeans. Sorry, a bit of Simpsons humour there. So some of the, that's obviously more of a hero model, the Esprit, but some of the cars in the movies that don't start out as hero models sort of become them, and I guess the obvious one is the Citroen 2CV and For Your Eyes Only, which I think is just fantastic. It's probably one of the best Bond cars ever, just because there's nothing special about it. It just gets the wheels driven off it and gets rolled and put back up and goes down hills and does jumps and things, all driven in a very calm manner by Roger Moore with one raised eyebrow
soaring away at the wheel, suspiciously.
Well, he doesn't actually start out driving, does he?
No, that's right.
The heroine is
driving.
But that, because people say the later day Bond films have been very much influenced by Paul Greengrass, Bourne sort of movies.
Yes.
That scene with the 2CV predates the Bourne Mini.
It's the same kind of
scenario.
And the Bourne Mini's not half as exciting, I don't think, just because of the way
it's
shot.
It's an old one.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, yes, the way it's shot. No, you're right. You're right. Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely.
My other favourite, only appears briefly, is the Alfa Romeo GTV6 in Octopussy, mainly because Roger Moore drives it dressed as a clown, but also because it just looks fantastic, does some big
skids. It features possibly the best handbrake slide in the Bond movie when he goes in the game.
That's actually a QV a Cloverleaf model.
Yes, yes.
That was one of my favourite cars when I was a kid. Very exciting to see it in a Bond movie.
What you didn't see afterwards was it sort of slumped off to one side, leaking oil and smoking desperately after that run. But
yeah, but that happens to all cars in Bond movies, so nothing unique there. Well, what about some of the sort of ordinary stuff that you sort of see on the periphery? That, some of that's quite interesting.
Some of that's very cool. That's one that's very cool. I was actually researching this last night by watching The Living Daylights again. And because
it's research, is it?
It's research, yes. I had to sit down and watch it. And because my favourite sort of Bond cars, not the hero cars, come from that movie, and that's the Audi 200s that he drives. Yeah. But just seeing some of the cars on the sidelines there, and I believe in one part in Tangiers, he's parked up next to all these big limos and things, and there's a 190E Mercedes parked just next to him.
That's cool.
It's just a beautiful little car just sitting there. It was obviously...
Just sitting there.
No thought was obviously put into it. It wasn't a car that featured in the movie. It just happened to be parked in the parking lot. And it was just a really lovely looking little car. But anyway, the 200s from that film are my absolute favourites, because it's a 200 Quattro that he drives at the start when he's...
Got smuggling. Somebody in the boot.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. General Koskov for the gas pipeline. But the
sounds like a euphemism.
The absolute best one, though, is the 200 Avant that he drives in Tangiers.
Oh, that's
an oddity.
That is it's an odd looking car. It looks like a quattro coupe with a couple of extra doors jammed in and a lot of extra length in the middle. It's just such a...
It's funny, isn't it? The Audi around that period, sort of in the 80s, Audi vehicles pop up in a lot of movies and TV shows, and I wonder what the reason for it is.
From
E.T.? Yeah.
E.T.?
Magnum P.I.?
Magnum P.I.?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe from what I can find, there doesn't seem to be any sort of paid product placement going on with the Bond one.
Something quirky and unusual, perhaps. Maybe it was sitting outside of all those general mainstream brands.
I thought you were going to say sitting outside the office when they went for lunch.
I suspect the Audi may have just gone around to a lot of film studios and said, "Hey, if you want cars, we'll give them to you."
Yeah.
Which was how it was sort of generally done in those days, rather than paying to have your cars featured.
Yeah, I mean, it could well be that they were on a push in the American market. I know the Bond films are British, but they're obviously very popular in America, and I think, you know, a lot of American TV shows and movies featured Audis. So
maybe. Interestingly enough, it was actually the 200 that was the car that almost killed Audi in America with the unintended acceleration.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, right.
Which was eventually changed back to drive rear.
Well, speaking of a lack
Who
of
thought?
Speaking of a lack of intended acceleration, one of my favourite boring-ish cars from the Bond film is the Triumph Stag that Tiffany Case, I think, drives to Amsterdam and Diamonds Are Forever.
I'm going to have to correct you there.
Is it not Tiffany Case?
It's Peter Franks, a.k.a.
Oh, it's Peter Franks.
James Bond.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, yes. No, I just, you know, you had me at Yellow Triumph Stag.
Yellow Triumph Stag, yeah.
I just absolutely love it. And again, another Bond car, which is probably leaking oil and overheating off screen, but just great to see it on screen.
Yeah. Oh, well, I like the Renault 11 in View to a Kill, mostly because it gets chopped in half and then driven wildly by a man who looks nothing like Roger Moore but is supposed to be. Terrible movie, but it's quite, I mean, a famous
same raised eyebrow.
Eyebrow glued up.
Famous stunt, and actually a lot of the stills that we use for promotion are of that car sort of doing this wild slide, being, you know, just driven by the two wheels with no back on it, and you can see the guy's face, and it's supposed to be Roger Moore,
so remember
it's
those.
Just not.
Go back to The Living Daylights, there was a bit in the commentary where they specifically referenced that, and Timothy Dalton was keen to do his own stunt, so they let him actually do a lot of the driving stunts purely for that reason, because they were so aware that a lot of the old Roger Moore ones was obviously not him driving the cars or doing the
stunts. And he would have had a lot of driving experience from his Shakespearean.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you can see that. You can see his driving skill level in The Living Daylights. There's a bit in Tangiers where he's driving the Audi 200 and he pulls up to a curb on a corner, rubs the curb with the wheel and hits a pedestrian. And it's very...
Sorry, I'll blow my chauffeur usually does this.
It's very brief, but it's...
But do you think he does driving overacting? Because Pierce Brosnan always did driving overacting.
Yes. Just soaring away at the wheel.
Yeah. And just looking too intense.
Well, with Moore, you always got the feeling that every single scene he was in was that's that take, you're done. That's all you're getting.
That's what you're getting.
Well, a lot of it, you were talking about Mercs before. Mercedes-Benz sedans actually pop up quite a bit in Bond movies, and they mostly get wrecked. I don't know. I don't know what the reason for that is, but there's that great scene in
BMW still pay them money to do that.
Yeah. Well, you know, ironically, this is pre-BMW, but there's a 250 SE, an Octopussy that he drives on the train tracks, which is fantastic, and well, I think that ends it.
W123 bodied Mercs were always big oligarch sort of cars, weren't they? And baddies cars.
And there's another one in, is it For Your Eyes Only, where he very famously kicks the car off the cliff? That's probably the only mean Roger Moore moment in any Bond movie, when he just maliciously kicks the villain off the cliff. He belts the side of the car. Great scene.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. And then there's all those kind of curiosities that pop up, which are not actually cars. The moon,
he knows how to drive. I mean, he's James Bond. He
can drive anything. He can fly a spaceship. He can drive a moon buggy. And there's that's Diamonds Are Forever, isn't it? The moon buggy.
Yes.
Yeah. Because the other thing in Diamonds Are Forever is the Honda ATV, all terrain vehicle, the three wheeler thing, which I think at that time would have been. They're very good in Bond movies at actually putting sort of brand new types of machinery in, and that would have been a brand new thing back then.
Absolutely.
And of course, very tricky thing to ride, but he can do it.
Absolutely.
And the wet bike and The Spy Who Loved Me.
First time we've ever seen anything like that, I imagine.
Yeah, it was. And that's the vehicle that's pictured in that movie is the actual prototype of the wet bike. So it is quite literally the first wet bike, the predecessor to the jet ski.
Wow.
Yeah, awesome.
Well, we seem to have wandered well away from cars there, so I think that's probably a good place to draw a line under the Bond nerdiness.
Fair enough. Yeah. You've got to stop sometime.
Exactly. We could go on for hours otherwise.
Do you know what? It's the end of the year.
It is the end of the year. Frighteningly enough.
Unless you're listening to this in June on your archive.
And please do.
Start of the year.
Please do.
Yes.
We welcome you too.
Yeah.
So we sort of thought we would just have a look back at the year, and maybe a look ahead to the Christmas holidays. We thought maybe thinking of a high, a low, and a surprise motoring experience of the year, and I guess it should be guests first, shouldn't it?
Oh, okay. Well,
Tell me you were doing this, he said.
Oh, I did come prepared.
What's all that writing you've got in front of you then?
typing. my motoring high for the year would have to be the Skoda Octavia RS. I used to like Skoda because they were something of an underdog, and I've always liked the underdog, but now I just like Skoda because they're Skoda, and they produce some pretty exceptional vehicles. I've driven more expensive cars this year, I've driven more technologically advanced cars this year, but pound for pound, the Octavia RS is just such an all-encompassing car. It's roomy, it's practical, it has some fantastic performance attributes, the way it looks and sounds, the fit and finish inside, like it's got sports seats, which actually are motoring writer sized as well, supportive.
Yeah.
It's got a lovely progressive steering feel, quick acceleration. The turbo petrol is 162 kilowatts. It's under 50 grand.
Yeah,
I mean, I just think that is just an exceptional. I haven't driven the wagon. I drove the lift back.
I was going to say, the great thing is you can have a wagon as well.
I mean, it would be more practicality, but not at the compromise of performance. Yeah.
I think the wagon looks a bit cooler too, personally.
Yeah, I agree.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I think that's fantastic. My low would be probably the Ford EcoSport. There's a phrase, I'm not angry, I'm just disappointed. And it's just, for a company that distributes some absolutely brilliant cars in class, like the Fiesta, the Ranger, even the Territory still is a pretty compelling package for what it is. This is just seems like such a cynical car to put into the market. It's tall, it's awkward, it's got a cheap interior. Worst of all, it's got the spare tyre mounted to the back door like a 5-year-old RAV.
And the door's hinged on the wrong side.
True, actually. You've got a Cougar in that sort of crossover space. I know there's obviously a price point, but if you ever, you know, you get into a car that you feel like, oh yeah, that's why it's this price, and I think that the EcoSport is that kind of car.
I think the thing that struck me about EcoSport is that it's supposed to be a global car, as all Fords are supposed to be now, but it's it's designed and built with such a regional kind of attitude. Mm. All of those things you've just complained about, they are all tailored towards the South American market.
Yeah.
Mm. South American market loves the spare wheel on the back door. The reason why the door's hinged on the wrong side is because it's made for left-hand drive markets and it's too expensive to engineer it the other way around, so you end up walking into the traffic when you want to open the back door.
Which you'd probably welcome after driving it, because it's not a particularly nice car to drive either.
And Ford interiors especially are very nice these days. This just feels like a throw.
I think the biggest disappointment for me about the EcoSport was that it's based on the Fiesta. Mm. The Fiesta is fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, I'd rather spend $26,000 on an EcoBoost Fiesta, that's for sure. My surprise moment, I think, would be, now, cue mocking derision, but I really, really liked the Kia Proceed GT, little 1.6-litre turbo hot hatch.
I have not driven that car.
That is, I mean, apart from letting you use all the control and alt keys on your keyboard when you're writing your name... it looks fantastic. It's really lively on the road. 150 kilowatt little engine, 1.6 engine.
So it's like a sort of like a Golf GTI rival, isn't it?
It is a Golf GTI rival, I suppose. It's 44K. Now, I say that the caveat on this is I haven't driven the Renault Clio RS. Now, I suspect they're similar price and similar power. I suspect if there's a heart and head conundrum, I imagine the Renault Clio RS is going to form the heart part of that equation.
Smaller car, though, isn't it?
It probably is a smaller car. But I must say, the Proceed was genuinely an absolute surprise.
I think it looks really cool. That's all I can say, because I haven't driven it. But every time I see one, and that's not often. But
No, that's true. You don't see
it is, a lot. It is a very cool
$1,000 three-door Kia.
Yeah. Manual.
The day. Manual.
Manual only, too. Manual, so
you've virtually just made it sail-proof with that.
Pretty much. Yes.
Order in yellow today.
Mm. I'm sure they could do a deal with Toyota and get a few Hiluxes out there with them as well.
So cynical. Shall I go next?
Why not?
My high was driving the Porsche GT3 on.
Again, the Porsche GT3.
Okay, that's enough. My low is the Toyota Yaris. Not because it's a terrible car, but because it's a cynical car. It's yet another very mild update of a vehicle whose powertrain dates back about 20 years. I mean, it's got a new nose on it, which looks quite striking. Some changes to the interior, but apart from that, it's basically the same old thing that we've been served up for as long as I can remember. And it's just not good enough. It's got a 4-speed automatic.
4-speed?
You know, a Volkswagen Polo that you can buy for, what, $23,000 has got a 7-speed DSG transmission and a great little engine. It's just not good enough, especially from a company that's got all the money in the world. And this is one of New Zealand's top-selling small cars, so I think they should be doing a lot better. Please do.
See me after.
Mm. Yes, good try. See me after class. And my surprise was the fact that I got to road test 5 plug-in electric vehicles this year, which...
That's amazing.
If you told me, you know, in 2013 I'd be doing that, in 2014 I never would have believed it. It's like the future's just arrived all of a sudden. So I started out with the Mitsubishi Outlander PHEV, drove the Volt again, which I had driven the year before, but it was good to revisit that, just in the wake of all these other vehicles. The Audi A3 e-tron, which I will admit is not on sale here yet, it's on sale next year, but I drove that both at the international launch, and also they had some cars out here for a bit of sort of pre-launch activity, so that was great. And the two new BMW iBrand cars, the i3 and the i8, which we are planning to talk about a bit next year, so I'm not going to go too deeply into that, but I think that's great.
It's amazing.
The future has arrived, and all of a sudden. My high was actually going to the Mini Stunt School in Australia for the launch of the new Mini. It was it's run out at the Mount Cotton driver training facility or
something like that.
Out near Brisbane.
Skid facility.
Yeah, the police. It's all used for driver training and all sorts of other things. Anyway, it's set up by two V8 supercar drivers, Luke Yeldon and Dean Canto, and basically they take you out and teach you to do silly things in cars, like J-turns and driving on two wheels. And all
so the J-turn, for those people who don't watch enough 70s TV, is when you drive backwards really fast and then swing the nose around and drive away.
Sadly, large stacks of cardboard boxes aren't involved. So you can't drive through them at a great rate.
That would be awesome, though.
Fruit sellers.
You're not made to put on a wide tie.
No. But it was a hell of a lot of fun, and driving a car on two wheels even if it was only for like 2 seconds, felt like it was forever, was awesome. Absolute blast. My low of the year was the extraordinarily disappointing Nissan Pathfinder. Not because it's a particularly bad car, it's not a particularly good one. Nissan are making a hell of a lot better cars these days, but the fact that the previous Pathfinder was based on the Navara Ute, and it was a proper, serious off-roader that was extremely capable. This one's based on the Ultima sedan, it's a CVT transmission, it's gone from a big grunty diesel engine to a big thirsty V6 petrol, and it's got a horrible interior. It's just...
It's basically an American vehicle.
It is a very American vehicle, but yeah. You look at the likes of the Highlander, which is also a very American vehicle, and it's done properly. It's got a nice interior. It can actually go off-road. It's still quite capable. But
so, hey, that's a gold star for Toyota in this podcast. Yeah. They've had lots of black marks.
Yeah. It's one positive thing. Compared to the Pathfinder, the Highlander is good.
Does the Patrol kind of up the ante in any of those... Because, I mean, obviously the Patrol...
Patrol is still a proper off-roader, but it's a proper expensive one.
It's, and it's only available, again, the American market strikes again. The Patrol's only available with a V8 petrol engine.
It is. It is defense. It's cheaper than the likes of the Lexus.
Yeah.
And the other big V8 SUVs.
Yeah. I mean, Pathfinder is obviously supposed to be their 7-seat sort of family vehicle, but that's...
But then what's the Murano?
You can buy it. Well, Murano's only got 5 seats, but I mean, the X-Trail's got 7 seats, yeah, if you want 7 seats.
To me, it's just a disappointment in the fact that it's gone from being such a... I mean, it was a good, comfortable vehicle anyway, the last one, even though it was very capable off-road, to just a... nothing. An American car that doesn't really
have any sort of
just you drive it, you think, ugh.
It is desperately lacking in character, which you wouldn't say about the other SUVs, I think, from Nissan, you know.
That's what makes it doubly disappointing, is that pretty much everything else in the Nissan lineup is great at the moment, SUV wise. Anyway,
just talking his way around the Ultima again.
Just yes, we'll avoid that. My surprise of the year was the Skoda City Go. Oh. A, the fact that it actually came here, and B, the fact that it was really awesome. Yeah. It was just a fun little car to drive.
They had wind-up windows and...
Oh, yeah, it was very, very basic.
It had pop-out windows in the back, actually.
Yeah, they didn't even windows in the back. Yeah. It was like driving an early 1990s Daihatsu Sherrard, except it was more powerful and only just.
Just to clarify things for the listeners, that is a compliment.
That is a compliment.
Now, you're using the past tense here, so you're saying that it's no longer available.
No, they bought in 25 to just see how they'd go. They sold all of those, and they didn't bring any more in because they just couldn't get the price to work. Basically, they couldn't get them cheap enough for what they should have been. They were $18,000 for the manual, and I think it
might have been another couple of thousand dollars for the auto.
I think it just ticked over the 20 grand mark for the auto. And the auto was a funny sort of single clutch piece of awkwardness that isn't all that great.
They missed an opportunity, though. They could have given them away as key rings for Skoda Octavia RS buyers.
They could have done it. But no, it was a great little car. It was actually a lot of fun to drive. I mean, it had about 3 kilowatts, but that doesn't hold it back. It sounded great. A little 3-cylinder engine. It was just so much fun, and I was thrilled that I actually got to drive it, because it is, of course, based on the Volkswagen app that Volkswagen, again, didn't bring here because they couldn't do at a reasonable price.
No, the app would be as expensive as a Polo, probably, and the problem with the Citigo is that it'll be as expensive as the new Fabia if they kept it.
Exactly.
So pointless exercise, unfortunately.
Unfortunately. But anyway, that was my high point.
It's getting towards a time when we probably need to hit the road, and it is Christmas holidays. But I just wonder, are you guys concerned about the so-called 1% speed rule, since we'll all be probably out driving a bit over the holidays?
No, because 2 reasons that I am not concerned by it.
It was very quick. It was a very quick reply.
It was very quick. Thank you for asking that question. Two reasons I am not concerned by it. One is that it's always actually technically been the case. All this hysteria at the moment about stopping us for going 1 kilometre over the speed limit was prompted by a press release that the police sent out, just reminding people that they have always had the discretion to stop people doing any speed over the speed limit, and they will be doing so over this holiday period. There's no mention of tolerances of 4 kilometres an hour or 10 kilometres an hour or any of this.
It's always been implicit, though, hasn't it?
It always has been implicit.
We've always understood that we've had probably around 10, and holiday times, they have come out and said, you know, 4.
And now they're saying... Well, they're not actually saying nothing. They're not saying anything. They're just saying, hey, we can stop you for any speed. And
two people have been ticketed in the last week, as we speak, for driving just over the speed limit. So that's brought it back into the news again.
And that brings it back to sort of my other reason I'm not worried, is that I have eyes and I use them to look at my speedometer.
It's hard to argue for... I'm a habitual speeder, but it's hard to argue for... going over the speed limit, because that's the speed limit.
I think what you're going to see this summer is a lot of police cameras set up at the entrance to towns, where it goes from 70 to 50, and they will be pinging people big time.
And I would probably say if they're going to do that, good on them, because if you're not looking at speed limit signs and can't see them coming, then you're probably not paying attention. The thing I do worry about is people being too scared to overtake now, so you're potentially going to get people travelling along at 90 k's an hour with 100 cars behind them because everyone's too afraid to
do
105.
But you know what, that's a typical New Zealand holiday season. Anyway.
Chuck a couple of caravans in the mix.
That's right.
Yeah, sweet. But the other thing that keeps coming up is speedometer error. That's a bit of a non-issue as well, because yes, there is speedometer error, but they always read over, don't they? And they read more over as cars wear out and tyres wear out.
So if you're doing 100 kilometres an hour on your speedo,
you are safe.
Unless you've changed your wheels and not recalibrated your speedo or done something like that. There's no way you're going to be over.
I think the biggest challenge for people maybe is staying alert when you're doing long distances. So what do you guys do to stay alert when you're driving?
I listen to podcasts.
Good answer.
That's true.
Which podcast do you listen to?
This one now. This one to check it's all correct. No, I listen to a variety of podcasts, but it's great. Talking is better than music. I think. As much as a big music fan as I am, I think when I'm in a long drive, I enjoy listening to...
I totally agree, and I have a long history of setting out on sort of early morning road trips and listening to talkback radio, not because I like it, because I loathe talkback radio, but people talking does help you to stay alert, I think.
Grown-ups radio is what we...
It is grown-ups radio, So I love podcasts too. I listen to all kinds of different podcasts, and I am actually even guilty of listening to our first podcast, you know, by myself in the car.
And that could induce road rage.
Not recoiling in horror, funnily enough. So what about you, Damien? You just go fast.
I just go fast. You know, lots of Red Bull, wind the windows down, crank the stereo up full volume. That tends to be my effort.
That's a slightly different approach.
That is a slightly different approach.
So not concentrating at all.
No, it's not. No, not paying any attention to what I'm doing. Same sort of thing. Just anything. Regular stops. Regular breaks to refresh yourself.
That is straight out of the AA handbook.
It is.
But it's quite true.
I find it works, because I stop, I buy a Red Bull, I hop back in the car, and I feel refreshed. And generally, it's probably not actually the...
Are you doing a Red Bull ad?
I'm not, no. Because I was just going to say, generally, it's probably not the horrible, sweet, fizzy heart attack in a can that's making me feel refreshed. It's actually just the stop to get it. Yeah. Anyway, we've gone on for long enough now, so I think we'll stop it there. Everyone out there, thank you again for listening, and remember just to drive sensibly this holiday season and don't do anything stupid.
Yeah, happy holidays and enjoy your road trips. We hear so much about the dangers of being on the road, and you know, you've got to be aware of those, but also remember that, you know, great Christmas road trips are things that memories are made of. I remember all the ones I went on as a kid, so enjoy yourself.
Thank you for inviting me along too, by the way.
Thank you for coming along.
I just thought I'd pipe up in the corner.
Excellent. And don't forget to go to our Facebook page, New Zealand NZ Motoring Podcast, and like us, because we want likes. So thank you.
Thank you.
See you later.
The New Zealand Motoring Podcast, brought to you by podcasts.co.nz.